be talking and probably informing to the FBI around Wounded Knee.
Well, I know there's 17 for sure.
17 informants?
That are talking to the FBI.
Do you know who they are?
They were talking about those people the other night. That's why I knew who they were.
What names? Do you remember any of the names?
Red Star family.
Paul Red Star?
That family, yeah. And Elmer Tutu and his family, and of course, Francis Randall. And his brother, his name? Oh, he has a brother. Anyway, his family.
Did they mention Carol Red Star?
Yeah, she's in on that too.
They mentioned her name?
They said, oh, they counted 17 out of these six families.
What other families, do you remember? Did they mention Pumpkin Seed?
Yes, Pat Pumpkin Seed.
Did.
And, what else did they name? That's four. Carl Schott.
Schott?
Yes, that's H-O.
Schott?
It's H-O-T-T.
Yeah. Ben Schott, too?
I don't know Ben Schott. I just know it's Carl. Who else did they name?
Rose Schott?
Yeah, Rose Schott was one. And this Hobart Spotted Bear. There's another one they named.
I think Rose Schott, I think, lives with Ben White Butterfly.
Yeah.
They mention him?
They just said Rose Schott.
No.
So evidently there's 17 people up there.
Who's this Hobart Spotted Bear?
Hobart Spotted Bear. He is. Did you ever know Silas Grant? No, it's his stepson.
Silas Grant?
Mm-hmm. Well, he died though.
Name,
yeah, he died during this time.
That's a very bad mind,
I think he's related to Gladys Janice or Gladys Spotted Bear. Yeah. Isn't it?
Does he live in Wounded Knee?
Mm-hmm.
Did he ever work at the trading post?
Yeah, he did.
He worked there?
So did Pat
and Carl did too.
Oh, I see. That's where they get basic witnesses from. Mm-hmm.
And Rose Schott did too.
Did she?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she worked on off there. And this Howard Wounded Horse down here. Yeah, he was another one.
Did they mention his name?
Yeah, they talked about him because they came up with 17 anyway.
Little Moon? You mention them?
No.
Hello?
Yeah, those were the ones they mentioned.
Yeah, they might be giving you the wrong information too.
Yeah.
What, these guys?
Yeah.
I don't think so, because I was talking to Pat one time and he said that.
Pat who?
Pumpkin Seed, yeah. But he said he knew everybody that went into the store that was there, you know. Well, I guess they were inside there anyway, so they knew who all was in there, who all took what.
Rice bags of love and the green. Thank you. Test.
Whether our budget has been decreased or not. You know, we do have to take this on two approaches. One is the fact that we do, the statistics I have had given me indicate, you know, a tremendous increase in services provided. You know, our outpatient clinic has gone from somewhere in the 20,000s up to 42,000 outpatient visits. Our inpatient...
That's a year.
That's a year, right. Our inpatient load has increased also. And all these things, plus, you know, the rolling inflationary cost of everything, with the fact that we get what money we had last year, it just doesn't go as far, you know. They say they haven't decreased our budget, or they tell us that they've increased our budget, but our budget has been increased for factors like a 4.7% increase in GS wages, or last year's, you know, 5% increase, or whatever it was, you know, in wages. All these things have come in, and it's showing a total increase in budget. But, you know, actually the budget has declined, and the fact that we do have inflation, increases in costs for medical supplies and all the rest of the stuff, and services.
So,
see, like, well, say 2 years ago we didn't have an ambulance service, and now we have 4 ambulances, and we, you know, they put, you know, 30,000 miles a year or better on all 4 of the vehicles, and we're renting the vehicles, we're paying maintenance on them, we're paying for the gas for them, you know, which is something that wasn't being done before. So, I don't know how we were operating then, but if it's traditional, it was, you know, if you can make it to the hospital, you know, you'll be taken care of. But now we have people bringing people in. And fortunately, the people that are driving the ambulances are volunteers. And, you know, this is a tremendous, tremendous savings for us.
Are they trained to? I mean, do they
have... They've taken the short course here. Good. Now we have 5 people that have applied for a 60-hour intensive course in Rapid City. But unfortunately, here we are again. We don't really have a contract, you know, that says we will train these people. So where is our source of funding for the training? Now, the training is free, but, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, $20 or $25 a day for 5 people for 6 days is, you know, $600 or something like that. So, you know, where do we get the money to pay them? Because, you know, the contract didn't agree to this. And we have to go to the council, I guess, and ask for it. I don't really know where we're going to get it at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have 5 people that want to go to the training, which is tremendous, you know. It's,
right.
So these are people that can save lives on the way into the hospital when they get through with the training.
So is it, with like the increase of people that are coming to the hospital, the increase in inflation, and the cutbacks in various departments of the hospital, causes like that doesn't give you a chance. Like, I understand that you have 20 beds in the hospital. Is that correct?
M&S, yeah. We have
M&S.
Well, take an example right now. Say we have a personnel ceiling. We have so many authorizations that we can put people into. Now, our funds, you know, don't allow us to fill all those positions because we only have so much money for personnel. So at the beginning of this year, taking an average number of, well, you know, an average amount of money per position, we had to fill 10 less positions than we were authorized. So. And because, you know, we really haven't set up to fire the people that, if we were to put everyone in a, you know, 1 to 100 need basis, you know, and then we start taking off, you know, number 100, you know, and working our way down, since we can't do that, since we're not in that sort of situation, we have to take the positions that are currently vacant. And so we wind up, you know, like we have 4 or 5 nursing positions that are vacant. So in order to stay within our budget, those positions have to remain vacant until some other position, say, that has a lower priority and goes vacant, and then we can hire a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
Or say we have a medical technologist or something along this line. You know, we have a variety of positions that were already vacant when we had to, you know, stay within the ceiling, our price ceiling. So there were things there, services, you know, that couldn't be provided because we couldn't hire the people to come in. And, you know, this is nobody's fault, it's just that we don't have any money.
Right.
And this is the thing that hangs it up. This is why I was happy to see the people coming into Porcupine, because that, you know, if there is a doctor out there, those services are being provided out there.
Mm-hmm.
that will give us some relief here.
Right.
Which in turn will allow us to give, you know, greater service to people that come in.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully referrals from Porcupine would bring people in to us sooner than that we could handle the problem locally,
right,
rather than having to pay contract funds to send it out to some other hospital where we'd have to pay $126 a day or $50 or $60 a day someplace else.
Right. To get back to, like, the ambulance services, they are funded through the government?
The government provides the ambulance, provides the fuel, and provides a repair on them. You really can't call them ambulances, you know. They're vans that are set up to bring in people. They have...
Do they have, like, oxygen on them?
Some of them do, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really very well equipped, you know. They have... They're nowhere as near a model city's ambulance
set
up.
Of course. Those things are, what, 20,000?
Somebody quoted that price to me.
They're really expensive.
But then the tribe, or, you know, the people in the districts... provide the drivers for them.
How about like your immunization programs? Do you have, are those able to be carried out like in a constructive, do you have enough money for those types?
Normally with the, I think with they have, there's joint state federal funding on these things, and these programs are carried out. There's, you know, the community requirements, school requirements, you know, all impose something
mm-hmm.
on there. There is a great deal of fear now, of course, you know, there's been some slackness on polio and stuff, you know. We've been reading, and I guess you have too, you know, in some
right.
of the medical journals that this may pose a possible epidemic problem. But here, you know, with our schools, et cetera, we do have an immunization program through there, and medical records are kept up. Immunization records are attempted to be kept up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Students are taken care of. I know I've been bugged several times about my kids' records down here, you know, but we haven't received them from Alaska yet.
Right. How about your dental care?
Well, I haven't really been that involved with dental at this thing. We do have two dentists here. We have a dentist out at Wombly. We have two dental assistants. I don't know what their proper title is now. Here, and then also one out at Wombly. They do provide services to the community, and of course they again are, you know, the general priority, whether they give priority to the younger children
mm-hmm.
up through school age. And then emergency or primary care, I guess, to the older people, you know, pulling and filling and things like this for the older folks.
How about like your alcohol? Do you have any alcohol detox programs?
Not here that I know of.
Okay.
This has been one of the big things, you know, and really the drying out centers, the sleep-in centers and things like this have normally been a community action thing
right.
that's become involved in this thing. I've seen this work, and, you know, one interested person can do a hell of a lot to get the thing going. And, you know, if you can get the community to provide you with a building, you get one or two people that have been through the mill and know the program, you know, they can run the whole thing for you, and the
mm-hmm.
community can do a lot, you know, for itself. If we can keep it. If we can get the police to cooperate.
Right. Okay, these are some questions that they had on like the hospital here. It's like, are the facilities adequate for proper surgical procedures? You know, like for instance, how many operating rooms? How often are the operating rooms used?
Oh, we have one operating room.
Uh-huh.
We have ENT is scheduled in there once a week or twice a week, I believe. And then our surgeon operates, I think, twice a week also in there. I'd have to check that out. I know they operate at least one day a week in there.
Uh-huh.
We, of course, for emergencies and all that, and these other things too, the rooms are used. And as you well know, we have a lot of trauma on the reservation, mm-hmm. so there is a great deal of abuse.
So, is the emergency room the same as the emergency room the same as the operating room?
No, it's not. We have an emergency room.
Okay. Do you have a recovery room for surgery? Or how do you...
Yes, we do have a recovery room for surgery, but, you know, it's... we don't consider it an adequate, you know, room. And plus the fact, again, that the two of the personnel that are not being hired are recovery room nurses, you know. See, there are two nursing positions in our surgical staff that are not hired, that are not on board at this time. And this means, you know, that we either don't have an operating room nurse or we don't have a recovery room nurse.
Uh-huh.
And so, again, this is where you get into the cycle of problems, and that you sometimes have to put your personnel back up on the floor, and then the floor nurses have to take care of some of the post-operative care. So you find yourself in this bind, you know, you're inadequate, you know, you're not fully manned in nursing, and you're not fully manned in the surgical program, so you throw more of a burden on the people who already have other duties that would keep them busy, too.
Right. How about, do you have intensive care units here?
We do have an intensive care two rooms that are given to intensive care. Again, you know, you can have an awful lot of equipment in some rooms, and I don't think we measure up to a big city hospital.
Right.
Amount of equipment and amount of care. Well, not care, but, you know, amount of facilities, you know.
Okay, well, the thing you told me already about that you had 20 surgical beds.
Well, we have 25 M&S beds.
What's M&S? What are you referring to?
Medical surgical.
Okay.
Okay.
Is that the total number of beds in the hospital?
No, we have 58 in the hospital.
58 so. In the hospital. And 20... Okay.
No, that's 25 medical surgical beds.
Oh, okay.
Okay, but because of the lack of nursing care, we have reduced that to 17 at this point. And then recently, or we had previously had it at 17, and then recently we brought it back up to 19 because we had hired another nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came back up to 19 beds. But again, you know, it depends upon what the situation is. You know, we will exceed that amount. And the people will accept the workload that goes with having additional people
mm-hmm.
in there, you know, conditions arise that require us to have people in there. But we try to keep it down here. We try to get things out. Try to get people to other contract hospital or some contract with somebody to put
mm-hmm.
somebody in there.
Do you have like rehab programs for like accident victims, amputees?
We don't have a physical therapist here. We don't have anything in that area there. In fact, is our ortho or orthopedist or whatever, you know, we don't have anything like that. We don't have any artificial limb work and things like this. And we don't have any occupational therapy.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any recreational therapy either. We just don't have the staff.
Right.
We don't have the area for it.
Now, the only thing that I had to go by was like the Oglala Sioux Model Reservation Program,
mm-hmm.
1969 report. And it said the five leading causes of the death on the reservation was number one, accidents, number two, pneumonia, number three, diseases of early infancy, number four is gastritis, and five is tuberculosis. Do you know if that's still basically the same?
Why don't you switch that on for a second?
Of the five leading causes of morbidity, too,
mm-hmm.
on the reservation.
The
tuberculosis.
Respiratory diseases, you know, are high, too.
Mm-hmm.
In the priorities, one, you know, the emphasis plan, they state that the problem, the first problem is lack of information and coordination of service unit and tribal health programs and activities. Number two is inadequate funds to support staffing pattern and service unit program services. Three is difficulty in recruitment and retention of professional staff to operate the service unit. Four, seasonal diarrhea epidemics. Five is inadequate service unit and community support of mental health program efforts. And six, inadequate first aid training program for health personnel. Inadequate physical facilities for effective service unit operation.
Now, who did this book here? Was this...
This is an annual plan that's produced by the members of the hospital staff, actually, are the ones that should be turning... Well, they do turn this out. It's usually the administrative officer and the service unit director would be the ones that would create this thing.
Is there copies of that available?
There should be, yeah.
Where would I...
Oh, Edie might have an extra.
Okay, well, I can check with her later.
Yeah, see what she has in here. The thing, these are supposed to have a standardized format, which makes it a little confusing for me here at this point, where you... Okay, on those items that you did, let's see what you have there.
Right.
What number is it?
Number
five,
three and four.
Okay. That's pneumonia. Let's see. I can't really. I think John would have probably given you a better answer.
Right, he did. He gave me a pretty thorough answer on that. I was just, you know, this
In general, those are normally, you know, the diseases that we face. You know, I find it in the Alaska report, you know, is the same thing.
But that's not germane to this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you pretty well answered, and it's probably in here about facilities for psych patients. That I know that that you've got the community mental health program,
right. Mm-hmm.
But I talked to Gayla Twist about that, and she said that they were underfunded and they didn't have enough people for the number of people on the reservation. And then Dr. Wilkinson told me about that you use the mental hospitals.
Right, we use Yankton and these places. People are referred out to these hospitals when they can no longer be provided any help by the local mental health program here. The local mental health program has been reduced. The personnel have been taken away from the activity here on the basis that we were fully, you know, we had a full staff at one time and other people had no staff or an inadequate staff. So on this basis, they reallocated some of our positions to other people. I attempted to counter this with the basis that it would be better to have one working program
mm-hmm.
in one place rather than an inadequate program throughout the entire reservation, but it wasn't a very good selling point apparently to the people that did not have anyone at all.
Uh-huh. How about, Dr. Wilkinson said that, gave me a statistic about 60% of the people on the reservation have tuberculosis, and is that correct? That you know of?
I wouldn't know offhand. I would.
What I was wondering.
They've had it at one time or have arrested tuberculosis.
Right.
This may be true.
Can you afford to do treatment on tuberculosis here?
Actually, the sanitarium in Rapid City was just, you know, set up for that specific purpose.
Uh huh.
And it is the one thing that we can refer to them, you know. Without getting into any hassle or administrative hassle, they will accept the tuberculosis patients up there. Again, the problem is, you know, isolation from family,
right?
Fear of travel, new surroundings, new physicians, and things like this cause some of the patients to leave. And again, this, you know, the cause is a failure in the treatment. And of course, we probably have some unreported cases based on the same fear that that they're going to be sent away to Rapid City, you know, and will be far away from their friends and family.
Right. How about preventative medicine or hygiene programs? Are you able to have any effective programs like this, like in the districts, or like talking with Margie Wilkinson, I understood that they have such a large area to cover and so many people that they should see that, you know, because of their funds that they aren't able to really...
Well, there are, you know, several things that enter into this thing. Of course, there is a large geographic area that they have to cover. We do have our field health programs. We get the people out to the villages and they attempt to set up clinics and work with the people. One of the basic things, of course, is that we do not have the funds to provide supplies to the people. And actually, the program is not set up so that we will give people things that they need for, say, basic hygiene or basic first aid care or you know, basic care of themselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we're unable to provide the basic supplies that they would need in this area. The program does attempt to get out. Hopefully, the doctors are going out into the districts more now. They've developed a district doctor concept, and hopefully they will be getting out to these districts and making visits. But at this point, we have a medics that does make visits to various clinics. We have doctors that make visits to clinics. And of course, at Wan Lee, we have a doctor out there.
Right.
On a full-time basis.
Okay, this next part of the question is like on living conditions relating to health. And that is like, if the people don't have proper diets or housing, can you see an effective medical program working without these situations changing also? In other words, what I mean is, you know,
Certainly. No, if you look at the whole problem, you have to realize, you know, that the social conditions and the economic conditions on the reservation do not allow for an elevation of health in this thing. If you have, a large proportion of your population is relying upon food that apparently is high in carbohydrates, which may or may not relate to gallbladder problems, which may or might not, I think has been proved, does relate to diabetes, you know, at a fairly early age. All these factors, you know, the socioeconomic factors, if they are not corrected or improved, you know, how can you run an effective program?
Right.
It becomes very difficult to, God, what's your intervention? I mean, where are you going to intervene, you know, to correct the problem? And what massive funds would it take, you know, to correct these problems? And how would you have a continuing thing, you know, based upon our Protestant work ethic? How would we be able to establish a continuing society, you know, that would actually conform to satisfy the taxpayer for the massive influx of money, you know, to develop something?
Mm-hmm.
And what would we actually do? What could be done? I mean, what do we have? We improve the housing, but then how is the housing maintained? I mean, if you take somebody out of a place where they've been providing themselves heat and fuel through wood cutting, and you put them in a housing situation where they're required to pay money for fuel, and then this detracts from their money to buy food, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get yourself bound up in it. In a vicious circle all the way around. There's so many factors that I'm not aware of. There's so many factors that impinge upon, you know, the health situation that it's really difficult to answer, you know.
Right. The thing that I've noticed too, and I've talked to Gayla Twist once again about it, and the fact of cluster housing has caused a lot of psych problems because people haven't lived in closed housing before. And therefore, the housing may be better, but the other problems that it puts onto the people is like a whole new set of social
requirements.
Right.
A whole new pattern of living. You know, I get. You know, I've had to talk to some people from Allen. You know, where their complaint was that if a friend gets drunk, you know, and they don't open the door, the guy will kick down the door, you know, to come in the house, or if you have anything to share, you know, they'll share, you know, until it's all gone. And all these problems, you know, and actually, again, the close proximity of living,
mm-hmm.
the friends, enemies, whatever, you know, the division of the community, any political problems. You know, you have polarized communities immediately by bringing people in into a closed area or a smaller, compacted area. And you have animosities, you know, that would probably not appear, and strains and stresses that would not appear because of the mm-hmm. proximity of the other people.
Well, this is a primary question that we're trying to deal with, is like, do you see any change in the health situation until living conditions, et cetera, change with the Sioux people here? I mean, like, it's, you know, there's only so far that you can go with medicine before you have to do something else, you know, and that is, you know, and that goes into so many different areas, like the food and the housing. Mm-hmm. And then that goes into unemployment, because unemployment is so high here, there's no jobs, so there's no way of making money to
continue,
right,
to support, to change. Well, see, again, here, basically, we're impinging, you know, the quote, you know, Protestant work ethic upon someone. And demanding, you know, that here we have given you these facilities, you know, now you must maintain them to the standard and level of other people, non-Indian people in other communities. It's accepted, you know, that medicine can only do so much.
Right.
And we're only working in one facet of it, you know, the total improvement. And again, I say, what is going to be the level of intervention? What's going to be the massive influx? What would be the general program? And would it be, again, a great paternalistic thing in itself?
Yeah.
You know, we're going to say, we're going to build an industry for you. We're going to attract companies in here. You're going to provide the workers for them. You know, is this kind of a dictatorial, you know,
really?
Orwellian type thing, I guess, would be the whole process. You know?
Well, the thing that I think that we pretty well understand is, like, rather than saying, here, we are here to help you, you know, is to work on the level of, this is your clinic, if you'll help us build it, and if you'll help us run it, you know, we'll train you, you know, and then eventually you can take over this clinic yourself, after, you know, you feel that you have the capabilities of doing this. And this is what overall hope is to do, because in various communities, like in New York City, there's one clinic there that's is trying to help 60,000 people, and it's not that big. So what they're doing is teaching people, like, in buildings, medicine, so that if anything happens in that building, they come down to them. Or they try to teach somebody in a large family, say a family of maybe 12, teach somebody in that family medicine, so that, like, in general first aid and emergencies, also have to detect, like, pneumonia, et cetera, hygiene, and spreading it out that way, because, like, the overall number of people that need to be seen that have no medical attention, they can't afford hospitals like in New York City. This is how they're working, and they've been doing this for about 2 years, 2.5 years.
Well, this is basically what the free clinic in Berkeley was trying to do too. You know, they were training people, crash squads. They were training street medicine type people. You know,
mm-hmm.
the freaks. You know, any whatever you want to call them. You know, they were. And training them to be able to provide help on the street to friends, to people,
right,
on this thing. This, I again, you know, the variety of diseases here on the reservation, I think, may make it more difficult for you. I'm sure that you've already recognized that
mm-hmm.
it is going to be difficult. There are many things that I have to deal with chemical analysis or laboratory work, you know, before you can actually pinpoint some of the disorders
right.
that we have here. Diabetes, for example, would be one of the great ones, you know, undetected at this point. The effects of malnutrition or undernourishment
mm-hmm.
On some of the children, all these things, you know, are sometimes not recognizable. Just, you know, by an observer with some training, basic training, you know. We will still need, you know, a good laboratory
for sure.
analysis.
Do you have laboratory facilities here?
We do have laboratory facilities here.
Good.
The fact is that I'm recruiting for a supervisory medical technologist right now. Hopefully we'll have someone on board.
Mm-hmm. This is like a relationship of personnel here in the hospital. Like, what is the relationship of white and Indian public health workers here? Is the cross-cultural situation broken down? What? How do the workers here feel about each other? You know, Indian and white, do they work together? Is there some problems there?
I haven't really seen an Indian, non-Indian problem in the hospital. I've tried to talk to the people. I've tried to determine if there is any sort of a problem going on here. I haven't seen it. Among the people that live on the reservation, there has been a problem of, political concerns.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some intensive feelings along this line. And again, I have asked people not to bring the problems to the hospital, that the hospital should remain objective and provide services to all people that come in, regardless of friendship, political affiliation, or blood relationship. And although it's difficult for many people to break down these patterns, and there are very many family demands, of course, that come into this, and I have at least tried to get them to accept the fact that we must remain neutral, that we must remain, provide the same level of service to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, again, what pattern, what have I inherited to begin with,
Right,
this
exactly.
is one of the things that I have to examine very carefully and explore, and you just can't pick it up overnight.
What do you think the morale of the white personnel here is? Do you think...
I think it's improved since my arrival. I don't know whether I'm boasting or not in this part. I think there has been some improvement. I think that I have accepted the fact that the medical personnel here, need it. Or I think that they found me a person that will listen to them and take some action for them, and
mm-hmm.
not be totally concerned, on the beneficiary side. But there has to be some sort of approach. Face the problem that we will have 5 physicians leaving this year, and we will have recruitment.
That's the thing that was interesting was how I asked Dr. Wilkinson how he felt that the people related to having a doctor for 2 years and then leaving, the doctor leaving. He says, well, one thing you've got to remember is this is the thing that they've always had.
The thing that I find an indictment against a community, possibly, or against a system, is that for all the years that we have been here and for the number of doctors that have come through this hospital and have been here on the reservation, that we do not have in existence a private physician in the community, or any one of the communities here on the reservation. What makes people, I came from Sitka, Alaska, not Edgecombe. I remember my wife went over to town to the hospital, went over to see a doctor in town, because I said, well, we had insurance, and we were depriving somebody else of service if we used the hospital facility. And my wife came home and she said, yeah, really, why are we paying money to have an ex-PHS doctor take care of me in town when we can have a PHS doctor here take care of me in the hospital? But I think of the 9 doctors that were in that community, 7 of them were former PHS physicians that had either been stationed at Mount Edgecombe. Well, I think most of them had been there at one time or another.
This is sort of a concluding question. Can you see that there can be any preventative medicine programs put in effect that would work given the situation right now on the reservation? And if not, can you give me, well, that's, I've got here, if not, why, and give you recommendations or changes needed to make one work?
Well,
I think.
Okay, first of all, let's start out. If we're going to have a preventative medicine program here, I think that the people providing medical care in the communities would need more intensive training. Your community health representatives, your community maternal health representatives should be given some form of intensive care, intensive training, so that they can provide us symptoms and possibly diagnosis on people, you know, that they're taking care of out there, and,
mm-hmm.
and then they should have the wherewithal, some drugs, some medical supplies, you know, that they could use. Again, the facilities for clinics and the equipment, you know, in most of the villages are inadequate or non-existent. So there would have to be some sort of a facility, some sort of supplies and equipment set up, you know, for them to be able to do examinations, to do, you know, go into the thing fairly well, and to provide good preventive medicine, you know, at the village level, before the disease or whatever it is develops to the point that they come to the hospital and then become a medical emergency, or at least some extensive, you know, medical care requirement. I think basically what are we facing? I'm not that familiar with this state. Again, are we facing licensure laws that would not allow us to do this sort of thing? Our nurses, our field health nurses, should they be given more leeway and more responsibility, and should the law be examined to determine if field health nurses can provide a broader range of care when they're out in the field without running the chance of license loss or lawsuits or malpractice suits or whatever you want to face? I don't know what the legal aspects would be on that point, but I think at the preventive level we need training for the people that are going to be providing it, and we need the facilities so that people can do a decent job of trying to determine what's wrong with someone.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is sort of, I guess it gets into politics somewhat, but the thing that a lot of people have talked about and have warned me about is the fact that when somebody comes in that's independent of the government and sets something up, and if they get too close to the people, that they are forced out and off the reservation. Do you perhaps see that could be one of the problems that happens to us, you know, like on Porcupine? Have you ever ran up across that before?
No, I haven't. I haven't been here this long. I don't know what the political situation. I've tried to avoid political involvement on any side.
Mm-hmm.
In an effort to remain as a neutral facility for providing health care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel that I can do any more than that at this point. I know that there are many important things that can be done at a political level, and I know that a person should become involved in the political system in order to improve the delivery of health care, in order to make changes and to facilitate expansion of care. But unfortunately, as we stand here and look at the situation, it seems that there's a tremendous polarization, and anything that you do at one level it has its negative aspect on the other level, so that you're losing as much as you're gaining. So the only feasible stance that I feel I can take is one of neutrality, one of attempted objectivity, one of providing a neutral facility that provides health care to all people of the reservation.
Let's see if that's working. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, what is today's date?
The 27th.
Today is January 27th in the evening, about what?
At 10:45.
I'm talking to Barbara Means and Sam Brim is here, and this is Mark Lane, also present. The first thing, I guess, that interests me would be the statement about the time the marshal was shot. When did the FBI indicate to you that they wanted you to give them the name of the person who did the shooting?
Oh, I was over at Wounded Knee on March 11th for that big meeting they had. And it was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I started back because they weren't going to start the meeting till 1 o'clock. And right about a mile from the house here, up on a hill there, and I had all my kids in a car when... And one of the kids said, "Look at that car up there." And I was directly, you know, up here. Mm-hmm. And you can see those cars pulling into the pine trees. And it was three at the time that we could see from under this big hill up here. And so then I rushed home. I told Uncle Adam, I said, "You go see who those cars are." And then he came back and he said, "Yeah, there's some cars up there. There's a red pickup and all." Oh, he named three other cars. So then I went back up there, and I tried to find Russell, but at the time they said he was at a private conference or something like that. It was newsmen. So then I came back, and we ate dinner, and this was about 1 o'clock. We had gone back up to Wounded Knee for that meeting. And at that time, there must have been at least 500 people there. And they all had gone into the teepee for that meeting then, but I was sitting on the outside of the teepee visiting with Pedro. And then I had that petition, so I was going around from car to car. And this was about, because during that time I did tell Pedro that we still had seen these cars up here, so then and then Russell came out for a break, so we told Russell, because that must have been after 1 sometimes, about 1:30. So that's when Russell sent that van out with Eddie White Dress and this Kingfish, anyway. And about 4 other young guys, I don't even think they were more than 16 years old. And they started down this way. They said they were going to check. So then we were at that meeting, and all of a sudden they must have left about 2, because this was about after 3, about 3:15, when that van came tearing back to Wounded Knee. And they pulled up right beside me, and that the back end of that van, you know, was shot out. And this Eddie White Dress and this Kingfish, they bailed out, and these other kids behind him, and they were all full of splendors.
Glass, me.
Mm-hmm. And all I saw them with was a 22, just a small gun. And so then I got shook up, because Russell said that he ordered everybody. He said, "All those ones that have children or women," he said, "please leave immediately." So my mother and I and the kids jumped in a car, and we came back this way. And here already they had set up a roadblock over here, because they start shooting at us. So just the way I was coming, I just turned in the middle of the road, went back, and I got out toward Pine Ridge. Hmm. And so then when I told the FBI in Pine Ridge that these cars were coming in from this side. So I said, evidently, either they're going to burn us out or something. So that's where we got on the subject of this FBI deal, and I told them that the cops were shooting at me when I was over here. And so sometimes later, when I came in with Dennis Eccles and him, this Eddie White Dress was telling Webb about this.
Webb?
Yeah, this FBI Webb.
Hmm.
He was telling him that, anyway, they drove down this way and they start shooting at him in an unmarked car down here. And so I was standing there, so then since I had seen Eddie in that van too, then we start talking to Webb about this. And that's what they're trying to make me say, that Eddie or this Kingfish shot this guy, but you see, I didn't see it.
Yeah, and you just saw 22.
Mm-hmm. And he was supposedly have been shot with a high-powered rifle.
That's what they said. Well, How many different FBI agents have talked to you about this and have tried to convince you to say that it was Eddie or someone else who did it?
About four different FBIs have been down here. But I won't change my story.
Are they trying to get you to change your story?
Well, you see, they've got three other witnesses, and they all have different stories. And they're trying to get me to say that what I had seen there and what I had said didn't really happen.
Were they trying to get you to change your testimony, actually? How were they trying to do that? What way did they do that?
Well, they're trying to get me first to identify all the ones in that van. But those four younger ones, I can't identify them because I can't remember exactly. I mean, they were just young kids.
Did they give you any names and suggest that it was one of those people?
Oh, they showed me probably about 300 different kinds of pictures. But most of them, I know them. And I just tell them, no, they weren't in there.
Yeah. Did they tell you to say that they would like you to say that Eddie Whitedress did the shooting?
Is what they're pressing me for, yes.
Yes.
By name, they're calling Eddie by name?
Mm-hmm.
And have they ever offered you any money, the FBI?
Well, at one time they offered me $10,000.
When was that?
Oh, that was when I was... Let's see. I entered the petition on March 19th. March 19th, let's see. Well, I started working with this FBI, that Roger Burrell Lynn.
Roger what?
Burrell.
Burrell.
And I worked with him for a good 2 weeks before I ever got into Wounded Knee. Yeah, that's right, March 19th. So it must have been about 2 weeks after that. And I didn't have a car at the time, and so then I was using a Dave Steele's car. He was a jailer, Pine Ridge Jail, and so he said his car was confiscated and was going to give him $5,000.
Who was going to give him $5,000?
The government.
For what?
To use his car. Because everybody was afraid to go into Wounded Knee. And I was the only one that was ever permitted inside of there.
How did you get in?
Oh, they wanted to know how well I knew Russell, how well I knew Pedro. So I said I had known Pedro all my life and I'd gone to school with him. And Russell, I said I knew him pretty well. And I said Dennis Banks, I knew him pretty well. But I said I didn't know Carter Camp. And I said, as long as Pedro's in there, I said, I know I can go in and talk to them, but I said, if Pedro isn't in there, I know.
And when, is that when they offered you the money for the first time?
Yes, they said that they were going to give me 10 G's, they said. But I really didn't think about it, because yeah. Russell had asked me, he said, did they offer you money? So I said, not really, I said, and I didn't expect to get it anyway, yeah. So I said, no, I said. Who he said, would you accept it? So I said, no.
Who offered it to you? Remember the name of the agent?
Roger Burrell.
He's the one. Where were you then?
We were in Pine Ridge. We were in a parked car. Because he didn't want the FBI to know he was talking to me. Because he said the FBIs were all, they were all trying to see who could solve Wounded Knee. It was more of a game to them.
He was an FBI agent?
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't telling the other FBI agents?
No. Because a lot of things Russell had written or notes that he had written to go out, Roger took those notes and he didn't turn them in.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
He told you that?
He kept them as souvenirs.
Wow.
A lot of the things Pedro wanted Roger Burrell to do, then he did them. And so in the end, Roger Burrell almost got, I don't know whether he got fired for it or not yet.
What kind of notes do you know?
Well, some of the notes had to do with most of that, those personnel carriers coming in and things like that. Because I think what the deal was what Roger was finding out from the FBI or what was going on was he was telling me, so then I was giving information to them inside so they knew exactly what to do to when they were going to use that gas on him. So Roger told me to tell him to fill all those big barrels up and to stick their heads in it when they should use all that gas on them. And they did have the gas there. They were going to use it. And so then Dolores Swiftbird and I had gone up to Frizzell's office, and we quarreled with Frizzell all day and told him that you couldn't do that to these people. And
use gas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Did they ever use it?
Oh, they came out with it.
Did they ever actually give you any money?
No. Because see, even if they did, I probably wouldn't have taken it because Russell told me not to take it.
Yeah. So they never actually offered it to you. They just
said they promised me. Yeah,
they promised me.
But they wrote it off. When was it? What did I do? Oh, on April 4th, you know, when Russell went to Washington.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to lay down their guns.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, Russell gets to Washington and everything goes well, they lay their guns down, come out, they said, you can have your money. So I said, I just laughed about it. I didn't.
Who told you that?
Roger Burrow. So I said, well, okay. Because I really didn't think I did anything bad. So. And here they didn't lay down their guns. So they wrote me off anyway, so I said, well, I don't care. I said, I didn't expect any money anyway. I said, and besides, I said, I wasn't doing that for money. I said, I did that because my own relatives and friends and so forth were wounded knee. I said, and this was all a political fight, I said.
Yeah, do you know of anybody who did take money from the government?
No, just the other person I was saying, Dave Steele, offered him $5,000 to use his car, and it was confiscated, and they still haven't. And I think there's papers written up on where they confiscated his car so he could use it to go into Wounded Knee. So here recently, Dave asked the FBI for his 5Gs, so they about died, I guess.
Do you know if they have had any informants in Wounded Knee?
Informers?
Yeah.
No, they didn't. Because I, as far as I know, I was the only one that was going in and out of there.
Do you know if any, if the FBI or the federal government in any way paid any of the members of the Goon Squad for the work they were doing?
Well, I think all the money that the OEO funds and all the money that went in to pay those goon squads, what they paid them, $8 an hour. And some of them were, that was all OEO money.
How do you know that?
Because my sister-in-law, Carmel Means, was a physical manager in Pine Ridge. And she's the one that made out all those checks for their payroll.
From OEO funds?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the government knows about that?
Yes, they do, because an FBI had gone to visit Carmel and said he wanted a photostatic copy of all the records, of all of that, and so then they got their copies.
When was that, do you know?
This was about the middle part of April sometimes, because Carmel got fired for that too, for giving out information to the FBI.
Who fired her? Wilson?
Yes.
Oh.
How did you find out?
Oh, I think somebody from the office saw her with that FBI or something like that.
Who was the agent, do you know?
No, I can't remember what agent it was.
Would she talk to us, you know?
Well, she's in school in Utah right now. I think she will, because, you know, they tried to kill her here recently.
Yeah, Sam was telling me about that.
Yeah, they
when
tried.
When was that?
Oh, when was that? No. I think it was here. And Leonard?
What?
When was that they beat Carmel and Robert up? I think that was in November.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was before Thanksgiving, wasn't it?
Yeah, we worked in the following.
It was sometime before Thanksgiving they tried to kill her, those about seven guys.
Who were the guys, you know?
Well, she named one for sure, Dennis Brewer.
Dennis Brewer?
Mm-hmm. And then he.
Did she ever complain to the police about it?
Well, it was right near the police station. It was early in the evening, about 7 when that happened.
In Pine Ridge?
Yes. And
how
so
far from the police station?
Oh, just around the corner, you know where the courthouse is?
Sure.
Just down that little ways from there. And so then, I guess, I don't know who told the police, but I guess Andy Condon came down, and he took pictures of her and everything else after, you know, took her to the hospital. And at the last I heard of it, Andy was supposedly pressing federal charges. Because Carmel, she was so beat you couldn't tell her face from her. Her face was just this big, and I think they broke her jawbone, I think it was. And
who else was beaten up?
My brother, Robert.
This is his wife.
Yeah.
Did they say why they beat them up?
Well, evidently, the way she put it was that they were laying for her, and that they knew she knew too much information, because I guess Dennis Brewer, when they had her down and he was kicking her and right here, I guess, and then she said she blanked out for a little while, and she remembers him saying, "Well, I think she's dead anyway," because they've been after her for quite a while.
Because of the fact that she knew where the funds went, and because she gave that information to the FBI?
Yes.
That's the reason. Did she recognize anyone else besides Brewer?
She named that, I think her name was Linda Goings.
Goings?
She identified those two.
What did your brother do when he was here? Did he live on the reservation?
Well, my brother Robert?
Yeah.
Yes, they lived in Porcupine. He wasn't... Oh, he worked at the housing, you know, when they were building these houses.
Yeah.
But after Carmel got fired from her job and so forth, then she went to work in Denver.
Where are they now?
And during the meantime, they put in to go to school in Utah State, so that's where they're at.
Utah State, where is that?
In Logan.
Logan?
Logan, Utah.
Do you know their address or telephone number?
No, you'd probably just have to call college there.
Yeah.
And ask for her.
Okay.
But she was so beaten she couldn't walk for days and she couldn't see for days. And
well, that was in November. Did they ever arrest David Brewer?
Not that I know of. So I don't know what ever happened to him.
I don't know what kind of a case they're working on. They're going to arrest him immediately. That's the first way to work on the case. November's a long time ago. Did she ever tell the police that David Brewer was involved?
Yes.
She did.
They both had new jackets on, so they took their jackets, and they also, I think she said she had $100 and took her purse. See, that's a federal offense right there, $100.
Right. Did they take her to the Pine Ridge Hospital?
Yes.
How long was she there?
I don't know how long she was there.
But she was an inpatient? She was admitted to the hospital?
I believe she was. I think for at least a night or a day or something like that. But I know they took her there.
How about your brother? Was he admitted also?
No.
He wasn't hurt that bad.
No. But he was so bruised up. Then they had a 7-year-old son when they... I don't know what they did to him, but he was pretty well shaken.
Well, he was there at the time of the beating?
Yes.
You think of anything else, sir?
When you were working with Roger, Was he giving you instructions as to what to do when you went inside and wondered, did he, or was he asking you for information when you came out?
Well, I think Roger was interested more or less of if the people, how hungry they were and what they needed. It was more that way.
Did he ever give you travel money or anything to get in and out?
No.
Did he pay for gas or anything?
No.
No?
I did all my own.
You say that he was interested in knowing if they were hungry. For what reason, do you know? Why was he interested?
For an FBI, he was more sympathetic toward AIM. That's where they took him off of being an FBI for a while. They said he turned AIM.
Well, he didn't want to know so that they'd know how close they were to starvation to close down the blockade. He wanted to know because he was sympathetic to the people. Is that right?
Yes.
I see.
Because after we told him our problems here on a reservation, you know, he really changed, because at first everything he looked at was more or less, you know, criminal way.
Yeah.
But after we talked to him and things like this, well, then he... But he didn't want the FBI to know who was... He didn't want the upper, like, Frizzell and him to know that I was going in or out.
Mm. How about David Price? Has he been sympathetic to him?
No. You know, every time it comes down, we fight.
What does he say?
Oh, he says that the AIM should be jailed for all the criminal acts they've committed, and then we have a big argument.
When does he come? Does he tell you when he's coming in advance, or he just drops in?
No, he just drops in all of a sudden.
When was he here last?
About a week ago. The day you were here, I guess she just left, and I pulled in, and he...
Well, I'd like to be behind that curtain sometime when he's here talking to you. My tape recorder going. But I don't know how to arrange that if he doesn't make an appointment in advance. Then just walk out, he'd really be surprised.
And about 2 weeks ago, all those FBIs were in Wounded Knee, and they were just giving everybody a bad time. They were threatening them that they didn't talk, Eastman was going to come down and arrest them.
Who said that? Did you actually hear that yourself, or people told you?
No, Wilson Littlemoon told me that.
Who?
Wilson Littlemoon.
Really?
Because they went to his house and they just threatened the heck out of him, so he told him to get out of his house. And so they went over to somebody else, I believe it was Oscar's Hallhorn, and they knocked on the front door, so they knew they were FBI, so then they didn't open it. Near the back door was open, so they came right in.
Without being asked to come in?
Mm-mm. They were really tormenting the people up there.
How many agents were there?
Oh, goodness, there must have been at least 12 of them. There were two in each car.
Six cars?
Mm-hmm. When this that trial up there just started, what they wanted to know was how much damage was done. They wanted an estimate, because evidently the FBI did not have no kind of estimate of damages or anything like that, because they also, Justice Department, also ordered Marion Taylor, you know, she's the head of that welfare.
Mm.
They ordered her to give over her copy, and very reluctantly she gave them that copy.
Of what?
Of all the estimate on damages.
So that the people turned in to me.
Mm-hmm. And that was just a survey they had.
Yeah.
Did those estimates have the items listed?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, that's what they're collecting it for. Sure.
Because they said they didn't have a case, and they had to have that as evidence.
Well, there was a lot of damage that was done by the marshals, the FBI, and the BIA police. We know that. We know who did the damage on the last day.
You mentioned earlier Tom Parker.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Is he an FBI agent?
Yes, he's the head of the FBI. And he was another one that I spent long hours talking with Tom, and I was threatened so much and everything else that every time I was to leave here or go from here, I had to have FBI protection around the clock.
Who was threatening you?
The goon squad. Oh, like Gerald B. Crow and them, they were out here. And so then when I was working with Tom Parker, then I expected to get shot at the time, so then I wrote him a 2-hour, I don't know, what would you call it? I spent 2 hours, whatever I said, they took it down in dictation and he typed it up.
What was it about?
They wanted to know why Wounded Knee ever happened and how I ever got involved in it and why I wanted to write this. So I told them I expected to get shots in case anything happened to me. And so they were supposed to use that in Sioux Falls.
Against who?
Well, it was supposed to be for the people here, as I was talking for the people,
yeah.
You know, why we got into all of this. Because I told that right from the beginning, way back and during the Yellow Thunder ordeal in Gordon, I said that Dick Wilson was an A member. And we had a meeting in Gordon that there was about 300 of us there that night. So then we all voted Bat Richardson as a president and Donald Lafferty as vice president. And
president of what?
AIM chapter in Pine Ridge. And I was voted in as secretary and Dorothy Lafferty was treasurer. And so then a few days later, we came back to Pine Ridge and we had an AIM meeting with about 1,000 people for about 5 nights straight. And that's when Dick Wilson started to pout. He wanted to be the president. He wanted to be president of AIM. And so then Bat Richards threw up his hands and he said, well, let's have another election. So we had another one.
And Poker Joe.
And Poker Joe got in and Gerald Big Crow got vice president and Emma Nelson got treasurer. And Mary Clifford got secretary. And so that's where Dick started.
He couldn't be president of the AIM chapter. He wanted to be the next best thing,
uh-huh.
President of the tribe. Huh?
Well, just then he got in as tribal president. And then during that time, he came over to my office several times and asked me what I thought of AIM. So I said, really? I said, I already committed myself to be a member. I said, so I can't. I said, I think it's a good deal. I said, we need something like that. And he kept bothering me what I thought of it, but I kept telling him. I don't know what he wanted me to do, but he really didn't come out with anything against AIM until November, when after that broken trail.
Do you think there's going to be some problems between now and Election Day?
I really do.
Yeah? Like violence, you mean, more violence?
Because while we were in that election office, I was there, I left about 11, a little after 11 sometimes. Gerald B. Crow and him were saying, well, all we have to do is kill Russell Means.
You heard him say that?
Yes, we were sitting right there.
Who's Gerald Big Crow? The police officer?
No, he's not.
Hmm?
He's Jump. Jumps.
He what?
This is his name, Jump. He ran for district councilman in Pine Ridge. He's a young fellow.
Oh. Where did he say that, Barbara?
He was saying that right in the hallway there.
In the BIA building?
No, in that tribal office.
Tribal office in Pine Ridge.
And
who else was there?
Dave Steele. So Dave said, well, let's get out of here, he said, because they're going to, he said, because there was only Eddie White Wolf and Louis Badwone and Marine White Wolf and Dave and I were the only ones that were not goons that were in there.
What kind of a meeting was it?
Yeah, that's when they were having that election.
Oh.
They were counting the...
Was it the nighttime or the next morning?
No, that was during the night. That was Tuesday night, about 11.
Did anybody else say anything when he said that?
Oh, some of them made the remark that, well, I guess we're going now. One goon goes, then the rest of the goons will have to go. And that Jim Wilson was saying, well, I guess I'll have to be looking for myself another job. They were really shook.
When they saw what the vote was?
Yes. And, oh, they just sat there and looked at me with pure hatred.
Well, if they're going to go, there won't be any violence.
But no. according to one that came to visit today, Anita Ekafi.
Who?
That's Joe Clifford's sister. She came to visit today and said that she was gonna die before she lost any of her property. She lives right up on a hill.
Who's trying to take her property away?
She said Russell's gonna give all her property away when he gets in. So.
They're crazy. They're crazy.
But I really think there's gonna be a lot of. What I guess Ted called Aberesque, but Aberesque said there wasn't anything they were gonna do, because this was the democratic way of doing things. If they were gonna fight, they're gonna have to fight.
Well, I mean, the first thing to do is to tell them they're not gonna lose their property. I mean, some of the police officers might possibly lose their jobs, I suppose, and Wilson will certainly lose his, but. Nobody's going to take their property away, the houses, cars, or anything. Where are they getting that information from, do you know? To make them believe that Russell's going to take their property.
Well, in Russell's platform.
Yeah, and what does it say?
It says something about, oh, well, they're going to take all the land back or something like that.
It's the treaty.
According to that 1868 treaty.
Well, the land that they get back in the 1868 treaty is everything west of the Missouri River.
And so that's what they, the way they understand it is that.
But then that belongs to the Indian people. It wouldn't decrease their property, it would increase their property.
Well, you see a lot of these Indians, like Bob Ekafi, her husband, relinquished his Indian rights some time ago.
Well, it'll be a long time before the 1868 treaty comes into effect, even if Russell should win on February 7th. A lot of steps after that.
You see, a lot of these ranchers are trying to sell out right now, too.
Is that right? It's time to pick up some cheap real estate, I suppose. Pick up good real estate cheaper.
Who was it that saw the, I guess, the statement that Coates got his $109,000?
Sievert was telling me that. He said he, whoever this girl was that worked in Aberdeen, she called him. And said she saw a voucher go through with Coates' name on it for 109,000.
You never got any kind of document from the FBI, did you? Any kind of papers at all?
That I was working with them?
Yeah, anything like that.
No, but they had me sign about 10 of them.
Saying what?
Oh, that I was supposed to be quiet and all this stuff.
Do the documents that you signed say that you were working for them?
Well, there was one that I signed that, Tom Parker and all of them, I had six FBI sign that, and the only copy I had, Pedro wanted to read that, and so I gave it to him inside a wounded knee, and I didn't get it back.
You don't have it now?
No.
What did it say?
Oh, it just said that I would be working with them and that I'd be going in and out of Wounded Knee. And that we were to be working on civil rights cases.
But were they really asking you about civil rights cases? Were they really asking you about what was taking place inside of Wounded Knee?
Well, I...
Or both?
Well, they couldn't really ask nothing about what anything Pedro or Russell said to me, because I won't tell him anyway.
Well, they could ask anyway.
Yeah, they asked me different times in different ways, but I'd say, well, I really didn't talk to him about that.
Like they did ask you who was in the van, and they were asking questions about inside of Wounded Knee.
Well, when those two FBIs, Parker and Webb, came in, they saw Pedro and him in the van.
Yeah.
Because somebody's giving them information, because the pictures are showing me. Whoever's giving information don't know the people, the names of these people, but they're sure giving them good descriptions.
Well, they have a lot of pictures which they took. I'm sure they had telephoto lenses on cameras all around.
But these are being drawn.
Drawn?
They're being drawn.
I see.
Because
These are pictures they've shown you recently, you mean?
Mm-hmm, just about a week ago. And they all had the same kind of hat on, you know. They put a hat on all these guys. And so I said, whoever's giving you, telling you who looks like what, I said, they're sure doing a good job. And the FBI said, well, he said, when we talk to people and give us a description, he said, we put all those together and send it to an artist. He said, and he draws them up.
Yeah.
But gee, they're...
What, do they actually look like people you know?
Well, there's quite a few that I know in there. But I always tell them, well, gee, I don't know this guy. I don't know. But they know I know Eddie White Dressley. He's the only one. I said, well, I know him, you know.
It's a drawing of him?
Yes.
But see, they must have a picture of him. He was arrested. He was in the Pine Ridge Jail fairly recently. It's easy for them to get a picture of him.
Because they should have had pictures, but they're drawing them, so I don't know what they're...
It's interesting.
And as far as any of those meetings at Calico, I didn't go to any of those. Just one night I went down there because they were having a powwow. That was on the night of the 27th. I went in there, and I don't think I was in there more than 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes. Because hardly anybody was really saying anything. They were all just sitting there looking at one another. And Russell came in and said hello, and he said he was going back to Rapid that night. And I walked out and I came home.
Mm-hmm. Think we're going to, do you have anything else?
No.
Think we ought to go let you get some sleep. And then you can talk tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And this will be the, I'm really glad that you came and that I had a chance to talk to you, because as I say, I got to go to St. Paul tomorrow and the last plane out, you know, the trial starts again Tuesday morning. Mm-hmm. The last plane out tomorrow is 3:48, which means I got to leave here by noon or so. How do you think the election's going? Think Russell's going to win?
Yeah, I think so, because all these other candidates, they've turned around and endorsed Russell.
Who?
Like Mario and...
He has? Yes. People shouldn't be worried about what will happen when Russell wins. I mean, the first thing that's going to happen is, I think, it's going to be peace on the reservation for the first time in a few years. And nobody's going to go grabbing anybody's property. That's just crazy. I think they're really, really good days, constructive days for the reservation, had it not...
Just like up at the school, they're so shook. They gave me 2 applications to apply for money, so I'd have money till 1975. Because Aberdeen called them and told them to get those applications in, because they said if Dick Wilson... I guess this is a rumor I heard. If Dick Wilson gets in, they're going to stop all tribal funds.
If Dick Wilson gets in?
Mm-hmm. And so they told us to get our applications to Aberdeen.
And how about if Russell gets in?
They didn't say anything about that.
Well, that's a good rumor to get around.
So evidently I'm going to be funded.